Welcome to Insta Poetic Justice, the first podcast of its kind discussing the ever-evolving terrain of poetry and technology and how these two have merged together to create the subgenre that is Insta Poetry. Here I will interview poets about poets as we weigh in on the positives and negatives of this new literary phenomenon. I'm your host, Amy Sophia Mayer. You can check out my poetry books at www.paganpoetess.com. Supporting me via my published works is the best way to ensure all these podcasts remain free and accessible to everyone. And now, on with the show. Welcome back, poetry lovers. This is episode 6 of Insta Poetic Justice. I'm your host, Amy Sophia Mayer. Today, I am joined by none other than J.H. Hard. Hi, J.H.
Hi, Amy.
Thank you so much for joining me in my little budding poetry podcast.
I am so happy to be here. This is going to be fun.
Yeah, I hope so too. So the format of this episode is going to deviate slightly from the norm. What I usually do is interview a guest poet and together we discuss the works of one of the Insta Poetry giants. But since J.H. is a giant unto himself, this episode is going to focus solely on him. He currently boasts over 200,000 followers on Instagram at Hard Poetry. In 2018, he published his debut poetry collection, War Over Easy, which I currently have here next to my notes. I highly recommend you go out and buy it. The best way I can describe it is that the style is raw. That's how it was described in the Amazon blurb, and I concur because it is very raw, but in all the good ways that make you think seriously about life. So, are you ready, JH?
I am.
Okay, wonderful. So I guess the first question, of course, is I understand from your, like, some of the bios I've read that you're originally from Tennessee, but that you moved to New York?
Yeah, I'm from Nashville, Tennessee, born and raised.
Music capital.
Music capital, yes, yes, yes. I grew up around a bunch of musicians and there were famous people in my high school. It is how they describe it, at music capital. Yeah, my family is from there. I moved to New York City around 2015 and I was there for 3 or 4 years, but I currently reside in Atlanta, Georgia.
Oh, nice. Was your move to New York, the typical, like, trying to make it in the big city, or was there any other specific motivation?
No. So when I moved to New York, I didn't even really write poetry, at the time. I was a copywriter for an advertising agency. TV commercials and stuff. That's the simplistic way to look at it.
Yeah. Like a modern version of the Mad Men.
Yeah. Kinda. I wrote, commercials for Snickers. Like, I think everyone has seen, like, You're Not You and You're Hungry. So I started out kind of writing comedy, and in advertising and, yeah, that was my story in going to New York City, knowing that it's the advertising capital of America, at least. So that was what brought me there.
And then what brought you down to Atlanta?
Advertising. I'm still doing it.
Again?
Yeah, I'm still doing it. Sometimes I wonder why. Because the reason I started really getting into poetry was because I needed some reprieve from kind of the dishonesty that you find in advertising. I don't want to completely, poo-poo the industry, but, you know, it can get a little bit monotonous and numbing. So I started sharing poetry, I would say, to feel like I was doing something more, giving people something that was real. So, yeah.
Oh, that's very fascinating to me, because one of the reasons why I enjoyed the Mad Men show so much, because it was going into those deep questions of, in copywriting, you know, they are, you know, it is a sort of art in terms of a creative outlet, but it's serving a wider capitalist machine, and what are the implications of that, and all those sort of things. So
that's true. It's a good point. It's a catch 22, I think, because the advertising industry is moving more towards empathy and trying to give people something that matters and trying to talk about the things that matter. But at the same time, you're still pushing a product to make money. So you can look at it a couple of ways. I think when you're really in the trenches, with the advertising industry, you can kind of see it is, it's art. I mean, I would say I do a lot of things. I write poetry. I make music. I paint, which very few people know. Nobody knows. You're a
favorite person
that knows that. Mm-hmm. A lot of different art forms, and advertising is the hardest of them all because you're always, you're keeping an unimaginative client at the forefront of your mind while also trying to be an artist.
Yes, of course. The client is always right.
Yes.
Okay. Wonderful. Thank you so much for that little intro. So the first question that I have written down is actually, it was something that was inspired from your little bio that I saw on Amazon. Mm-hmm. So it says here, he began writing as a school requirement, once described by a history professor as, quote, the worst writer I've ever had the displeasure of teaching, unquote, he decided to continue it beyond his schooling for some reason. So would you like to tell us a little more about that? I'm just curious about your journey. You mentioned it briefly, part of poetry being an outlet from advertising, but I'm very curious how you went from being told off by this, you know, quote unquote gatekeeper into realizing that people cared what you had to say and what you had to write.
Yeah, I was a bad writer and I still don't know if I'm good, but my family used to make fun of me because I come from a family of writers and professors and teachers and poets. And my mom always used to say, you know, it's like, it's not your strong suit, like writing papers. And I used to think that I was good. I would write a paper and I'd be like, oh, this is great. And I'd come back with like a 70 on the test. Well, I wrote a history paper and it was the first time that I looked at the paper and I said, that is good. I know that's good. I know everyone says I suck, but that is good. And I got a 33 out of 100 on the paper, which was just absolutely, I mean, that is terrible. And I went to his office and I was like, you need to explain more, because I didn't really care about school. I kind of just did it. I did enough to get by. This was the first time I went to a teacher that I can remember and said, I need you, because I enjoyed writing. You know, this wasn't like a chemistry test where I was like, who cares? No one cares. I went to him and I was like, what is wrong with this? And he point by point went through everything and was just like, I got to be honest, I had written a few more papers and they were failing. He was like, you're probably one of the worst writers I've ever seen. And I was like, damn, that's hard to hear. But advertising is where I really blossomed. I think about around that time when I went to my teacher and asked why, I was becoming more curious about writing. I was writing music, lyrics, you know, little haikus and stuff. And I needed a 9-to-5, or I thought I did. And I was like, okay, advertising, I can write commercials. I'm funny, I think, and I can write enough. I don't need to write long papers. I can just write little jokes for advertising. That's what I thought it was. So I learned how to write in my postgrad creative. It's called the Creative Circus in Atlanta. around 2013, I learned how to think, I guess I would say. And that sort of, I really blossomed over a span of about a year in 2013. Really started exploring with poetry.
Yeah, fascinating. So that, I'm sure that professor is eating his words now.
I don't know. Maybe I should ask him. Maybe I should check and be like,
you should drop him a line.
Yeah, and he'll be like, who are you? Like, yep, sorry.
Yeah. So, you know, going off of that point, because, you know, you seem to think that you're such a bad writer. So my second question is, what, in your opinion, are the most important elements of good writing?
I think, oh, God, that's a good question. That's a really good question, because
it's simple, but deep.
I don't know. I don't know, because it's funny, actually. I was just reading. I have a collection from a writer named Ed Smith, who was sort of a punk poet from the 80s. And he's not good. He's not good. I think objectively, if you read his stuff, you'd know Ed Smith is not good. But there's something about some of the things that he says that are so stupidly intriguing that there's flashes of brilliance. I don't know. I don't really know how to describe what would make good writing. I think it's just when you read it and you haven't quite heard it said that way, and it resonates with you, I think that that's good enough.
Yeah, I would have to agree as well, because I'm a big component. I'm a big advocator for there are very few things that are truly originals, and it's okay to go back to cliches and stuff as long as you say it in a slightly different way.
Yep, I agree.
So next question, what is the most difficult part about writing for you?
I don't think that there's anything difficult about the actual process of writing. I think what's difficult about writing is not having the inspiration. I think that anybody can write well if you're inspired to do so. If you truly desire to be good at it, I think you can muster up something that matters. I think it doesn't have anything to do with the writing, but finding the reason to write. I think that that's the toughest thing.
It's like the beginning is always the hardest.
Yeah. So I don't even write if I'm not feeling it. I just will not do anything. I'll just sit there and watch basketball and just completely forget that writing exists until like a little thing just makes me think about, you know, something, and then I'll sit down and I'll write.
So you are the type of writer then that sort of, I don't know if embrace is the right term, but you just roll with the punches when it comes to writer's block. You don't try to fight it in any way. You just, you know, go with the flow.
100%. And I think in my experience, writer's block only ever happens when I'm trying to compare myself to someone else or I'm trying to write like them. I'll see something great and I'll try to emulate that.
Mm-hmm.
That is when the writer's block comes. Because you're looking at somebody that is iconic in your head, and you think I'll never be that. And so then the confidence is shot. Good writing, or the ability to write, is a combination of confidence and inspiration.
Very true. So next question, if at all, how has COVID-19 and or the racial tensions or the upcoming elections in the U.S. impacted your writing process, if at all?
Well, I don't think that COVID, I started writing a little side project called Love in the Time of COVID. And then I saw on TV commercials about a TV show called Love in the Time of COVID. And I got pretty mad about that.
Oh.
But I was writing things that were kind of based on the thoughts that I was having. Maybe I can read those later if I can find them. In terms of racial tension and politics, I try not to get too involved, because I come from a place where there are many different points of views. So I have very left-wing people in my family. I have very right-wing people in my family. Mm-hmm. I have members of the LGBT community, Black people, Hispanics in my inner circle. Everything around me is swirled into this strange amalgam of quiet tension, and I just avoid it because I don't feel the need to get involved. I think I've had people ask me why I don't get involved and try to tell me that I should get involved because I have a big voice. And to that, I would say I'm here to provide you with thoughts of love and maybe some humor and, you know, maybe moments of sadness. I'm going to leave all that to the other people, because we don't need to be bombarded with politics all day, every day. And for me, what really resonates with me as a writer is writing about my problems or moments of love, you know, things like that. Like, that's me, and I'm not going to change who I am because people want me to.
And of course, that is a perfectly legitimate position to have. It's just interesting to see the spectrum of, you know, some poets use poetry as a means, as a sort of escapism, where I was just in an episode or two ago discussing the works of Cleo Wade, and Cleo Wade is on the opposite end of the spectrum, where she like is super, super active, like politically.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I think that's great, you know, do that. I think it's necessary. I mean, I think we can all agree on that. Depends on who you are, but most of us can agree that those are needed. That stuff is needed. She's doing that, and people are hearing her voice, and her voice from a racial position is more important than mine. So, yeah,
Yeah. Wonderful. Again, nothing wrong with staying out of it. That's basically what I'm doing at this point. I'm hiding from everything with my poetry podcast and BookTube.
Good. Do it. Everyone should hide from all the troubles, and we can go back, reset our brains, come back together, and love each other. That's the way I look at it.
If only. So next question. What made you want to step off of Instagram and publish a physical book?
Oh, I don't know. I had time on my hands. I had a bunch of poems that were just kind of rattling around in my computer. And most of the stuff that, you know, you've read my book. So, you know, most of the stuff in my book is longer than what you see on my Instagram. I'll pull little excerpts from those poems. Pretty much everything on my Instagram is an excerpt of something longer. And I just wanted people to see it. You know, they were just kind of sitting in a document and people are seeing two lines of it. And I don't like putting full poems on Instagram because they mean more than that to me. Instagram is such a dry, kind of a emotionless place. Sometimes you kind of like, if something's too long, you just scroll over it and you don't read it. And that's why you put 2 to 3 lines on something. But I needed this book to encapsulate all of what I was feeling in any given moment, and how this lives in the world. And I think that that's beautiful. It's on paper and people can go back to it. They don't have to go onto an electronic box and social media to go find it. They can go to paper.
Yeah, wonderful. So did you self-publish or traditionally publish War Over Easy? And what led you to that choice?
I self-published because I didn't have any publishing deals lined up. I was still relatively small when I began publishing it. I think I was at about 50,000 followers. And I don't know. I kind of just wanted to do it on my own anyway, just to say that I did it. So I can always say I did everything, right? Like the whole thing, that was all me. And I'll always be proud of that. Even if it could have been done better, could have been marketed better, I did that. So, it's definitely a sense of pride.
No, nothing wrong with that. My sentiments are very similar. Like I have 2 poetry collections and I did not even consider going to traditional publishers. I self-published them. And again, that sense of pride of I did this all by myself. I took absolutely knowing nothing about book cover design or formatting and I was able to create a book and I've gotten good reception from it. So yeah, I'm happy.
I love it. Yes. I think that that's so important to just be able to do that. It's freeing.
Mm-hmm. So yeah. So one question I have is, what is the significance of the title? And I was always curious about the title in general, but extra curious because some poetry books I will read like in chronological, you know, in order, you know, from beginning to end. Some poetry books I will like skim, I will like jump randomly through poems. And just with your book, I just happened at random to fall on page 127, which has the poem that has that phrase in the poem, which is we'll be back. We were dysfunctional, colloquial chaos, screaming at dawn, war over easy. And I'm like, oh, I already got to the title of the book.
I know, that's so funny that you did that. Yes. I was just scrubbing through. Okay, so you want to know, ask the question.
Just what is the significance of the title? What specifically? Because it's just a very interesting title.
Got you. I've had a lot of people ask me, and usually I just ask them to tell me what they think it means. I won't make you do that. I won't put you on the spot unless you want to.
No. Tell me yours first.
Okay. I was in a pretty dark place when I was writing the book, when I was trying to finish it. It was one of the last poems that I wrote in the book. And I just realized every morning I was kind of like waking up ready for another day of hell. And I just every day felt like a new war. And it was just, I was thinking about the way you scramble your eggs or, you know, you get them over easy or over medium or over hard. Like, how many ways are there to cook an egg? And every single morning I wake up and I'm just like, what kind of hell am I going to be in today? What kind of war am I going to be in today? War over easy.
Right. Interesting. Yeah. Makes sense. Cause it's certainly, yeah, you can definitely infer that from the poem screaming at dawn, war over easy, just the type every morning there's going to be a new war that has to be fought.
Yeah. Yeah. And so I wrote the line before I wrote the poem. I wasn't thinking about a title or anything. It was just a thought that came to my head. And I was like, I like that. I want to work it into a poem. And I did. And then scrolling through the book, I was like, okay, maybe that could work. But I went through hundreds and hundreds of titles, consulted with a bunch of fellow poets, friends, roommates, family members, whittled it down to a few, and then I just landed on that.
Oh, wonderful. Yeah, no, I was just really curious because I'm sure there are other poets who, you know, title their poetry collections in a similar way with just like one stanza from within a poem becomes the title, because it's just totally foreign to how I title my poetry collections, because most of the time I will have the title of the collection will be the title of what I consider to be the most important poem within the collection. So it was just interesting to see like, oh, it's not a title of a poem. It's actually just part of one of the poems.
Yeah, I don't know if that was unconventional or not. It just felt right. I just wanted to do exactly what felt right. And it just kind of struck me.
Yeah, wonderful. So let's see. My next question. How do you deal with literary criticism? And beyond that, what are your feelings about the tensions between the traditional poetry establishment and insta-poetry? Do you think the establishment is wrong to dismiss insta-poetry, or should insta-poetry remain in its own category, like the way we distinguish between literary and commercial fiction?
Okay, so criticism, I don't get that much criticism. In no way is that me saying that it's because I'm so good. I just don't get it. I think I've had a few people here and there comment and say like, oh, this isn't poetry, because it's one or two lines or something. And I ignore it because I kind of acknowledge that it's not poetry. It's just, it's a thought on a piece of paper. I don't really know how to describe poetry.
Well, who does?
Exactly, right? So that kind of is a segue into the tension between, you know, insta poets and the traditional guard. I know why they get so angry, and I don't disagree with them. In fact, I'm kind of on their side. The traditional world of poetry compared to Instagram, they work so hard at crafting. They take classes. They spend money. They go to school for it. They study it. They eat, sleep, breathe poetry, and they'll write 10 pages for one poem, spilling their honest guts onto it. And then they'll go stand up in front of people and they'll read it. Insta poets say, you know, I love you, but you don't love me back, and then sign their name underneath it. And you didn't put the time in to do that, because anyone can do that. You're not going out and standing up vulnerably in front of a crowd that is going to criticize your work to hell. So I get my old roommate, when I lived in New York, she was a poet, and she would go to those. She used to go to the Brooklyn Yop Club, which was a poetry reading thing. She used to do it all the time, and she always asked me to go, but I just never did. Because back then I just was not in a great headspace and I didn't want to go anywhere. That was that. But she was one of those people. And when I told her that I had this Insta thing going on, I was at about 32,000, 33,000. I remember telling her, and she was supportive, but you could see it kind of on her face that all of this, you know, she was making these poems and maybe she had thought about Instagram poetry, but you know that because I remember her talking about Rupi Kaur one time and telling me, just expressing her disdain for Rupi Kaur. And I hadn't told her yet that I was, you know, putting out my poetry on Instagram. But when we talked about it, because she had read my long, real pieces, you know, the kind of stuff that's in my book. And she was like, I get it now what you're doing. So I think that the tension can be solved if you kind of come together and you understand what each other is trying to do rather than criticizing the other. You know, I think that the more traditional poets just criticize and they don't really try to understand. So when Alex and I had our conversation, my old roommate, she was like, I get it now. I get it because I see this is a few lines, but this is the full poem. And I see that you're trying to connect with people who don't necessarily want to sit through my long diatribe of, you know, some romanticism or something. So that's a long-winded way of saying I'm more so on the side of the traditional guard, but I think that that both sides have something in common.
Fascinating. Thank you for sharing that with us. That's a very good perspective that I don't think we've heard yet. Because yeah, I can kind of understand the sort of frustration and the sort of, you know, quote unquote envy that, you know, you devote yourself so much to the traditional way of doing something, and then you feel like these random people on Instagram are like cutting corners. But I think you're absolutely right. It's about, I don't think, just not holding Insta poetry to the same specific criteria of traditional poetry, or again, exploring the possibility that maybe a lot of poets are doing what you are, just several lines of what is a longer poem and what they would deem to be, you know, a legitimate piece of work, and just, you know, how you're not giving up your longer pieces of work. You're still writing them, but you're still adapting to technology and the times to, you know, possibly reach out to people.
Yeah, I think I'm bringing the depth of what I do have to offer behind the scenes to the people who would not seek that out. So when somebody goes to my book, they're not going to see much of my book on my page, but they're going to get the same voice. They'll know that that's JH. It's still the same, but they're getting a 3-page poem that's the same sentiment. I'm just making you think a little bit more. You got all the way to the book. You're going to read it. So that's part of why I do it too.
Fascinating. So let's see. Next question. Do you think you will want to publish another poetry collection in the future?
Yeah. I have one that's done. It's a little bit shorter, so War Over Easy is what, like 180 something pages?
We're like at 180 pages.
Yeah, so this one is only about 85 pages. But I look at it and I think it's done, you know? I struggled with that because I was like, should it be longer? I don't know. So it's done, and I'm sort of just stuck in a limbo with titles right now. I'm thinking of titling it A Belly Full of Drunken Hummingbirds.
I love that. I just have a special affinity for hummingbirds because I have a hummingbird feeder, and you know, they'll come in near the window, but sometimes when we leave the patio door open, sometimes they'll fly into my house.
Oh, you gotta be kidding me.
Yeah, they'll fly into my house, and I have a condo that has a high vaulted ceiling, so we'll have to wait until the hummingbird exhausts itself to finally land and then catch it and then put it back outside.
See, that's a beautiful problem to have. I was in New Mexico a couple of weeks ago. I just wanted to like live out in the middle of the desert and just solitude. And we had a hummingbird feeder, my friend built a little tiny home. It's very, very tiny, about the size of a big living room. And I just lived in that. And he had hummingbird feeders out on the back patio. And there were always hummingbirds just like flying. And you could kind of hear them too, because like the walls are thin and everything. I love hummingbirds. Yeah. And that title, it wasn't from a book or anything, or from a poem or anything. I just, I was thinking about butterflies in your stomach, because a lot of this second book, so the first one is very dark, you know, but I've been in a pretty good place. You know, I started writing the second one after I left New York. I started getting my health right, getting back in shape. And the poems are pretty optimistic. And I was falling in love with this girl at the time. And I remember thinking about, it wasn't necessarily butterflies, but it's something more intense. And so I just thought of like a belly full of drunk hummingbirds. I don't know. It's just, you know, a far more intense feeling than just butterflies fluttering inside of you.
Yeah, well, again, I think that's a mark of a true poet, taking a sentiment universal to the human condition, but not solely relying on the typical butterflies in your stomach. You create your own euphemisms for it.
Yes.
Yeah, so I think you might have already touched on this. The extension of the question was, how would the themes differ or continue the message of war over easy, which you just said that they would, and this collection would be much more optimistic. Is it optimistic? Is it trying to serve as a precise contrary to war over easy, or does it deviate slightly in themes if the tone is the opposite? So
I don't. So there, that is one thing that I don't know if I'll say a majority of Insta poets, but I'll say a good number of Insta poets will write a book and then they'll create a theme based on the book. I don't believe in that. I think that doing that minimizes your honest journey in your life, because what you're doing is you're using, I think that poetry is written, and I think that poetry is an artistic form of just, it's a journal, right? Mm-hmm. Like, let's look at my journal. If I've been journaling all day, every day, and I start into another book, but I'm in a different place in my life, why am I going to refer back to that journal? I think that I want to make sure that whatever book I'm putting out is a collective of the organic feelings of now, rather than looking back at War Over Easy and saying, okay, that's what I did then. Now let me see how I can bring JH back then into this. No, I don't think that it should be that way, because I'm not telling, you know, it's not like Lord of the Rings or something where you need, yeah, it's like you need that first one and then it's got this and you're telling a story. Emotions are different. I don't think there's anything today that takes me back to War Over Easy. So I'm not going to go back there.
Mm-hmm. Interesting. I'm just curious because I have in my head that I'll have poetry collections that, you know, are totally different, but from my, each other, and they'll stand on their own. But I am in the midst of a specific poetry series that I'm calling The Haunted Relics, and the first one, my debut collection, was Ghost in the Locket, and then the next one will be Vampire in the Rear, and they'll each have their own themes, but they all will sort of maintain this sort of gothic vibe. And so, yeah, it's just interesting to see how different poets approach, you know, issues of theme. And you're definitely seeing the type, you don't want to keep a theme, you want to keep everything like real time, and I think that's part of your, the raw honesty of your style.
Yeah. And I think that that's cool. That you're creating that, you know, what was it? What in the Front and Vampire in the Rear?
Yeah. So the first one is Ghost in the Locket.
Yes.
And then the second one will be The Vampire in the Mirror, and there'll be five. And so the goal is to hopefully publish one of the Haunted Relic series each, once one poetry collection per year, so that hopefully I'll finish the fifth one by 2023.
Yeah, but see, that's awesome. You're looking at them as a series. You're already doing that. So I think that it makes sense to do that.
Yeah, definitely from the beginning, I know this is a long-term series that I wanted to do. It's not like I wrote something that I knew that I didn't think would have a sequel or anything, and I'm trying to force a connection retroactively or anything.
Exactly. So, you know, with War Over Easy, it was a body of work sitting on the computer that spanned a tough time, a tough year and a half of my life. And I knew that I was about to leave my job, and I knew that I was not long for New York City. I knew things were moving, and I was like, okay, it's time. Let me release this. And I finished writing it May 2018. Like May 24th, I think. I remember the final day. And I got laid off from my job like 6 days later.
Oh, no.
No. It was a good thing. It was they had lost a bunch of business. It was a whole thing. But I knew that I was about to move on to a new chapter. And that's kind of the way I looked at the book. It was just like, this was a thing from now. And then I began writing the next book after I moved out of my apartment. So, you know, it's a completely different thing. So.
Wonderful. So I think just two more questions left. So who are your top three favorite contemporaries in Insta poetry or modern poetry in general, and why?
Oh, I don't know why I didn't expect that question, but maybe I should have. Oh, man. It's hard. It's really hard. I would say Charles Bukowski is always up there because, mm-hmm. you know, can I cuss on here?
Yes. Yes, you can.
Okay. I would say Charles Bukowski is he's always up there because he just really doesn't give a fuck. Like, I have never read anything from anybody who gave less of a fuck. And I think that he could have easily played a role, or I mean a character, and he didn't. You look at his poems, and some of them will be him fetishizing like a 13-year-old girl. And you're like, how in God's name could you be okay with publishing that? And it's and then he'll write something that is like beautiful about like loving, you know, his wife. And you look at that and you're like, these look like different people. But that's because I've never, because he's the one person that I've read that I can tell that no matter what is happening, he's taking exactly what is in his fucked up brain and he's putting it on paper. And so the controversy around him, you know, kind of this LA garbage beatnik poet, my aunt, she's a poet and she's really good. And she was a teacher for many years of poetry and of English. And she absolutely hates him because of the things. And I love him because of those things. And she's very neat, right? Her writing is very neat and tidy. And like, she'll write something the way she writes, even if she doesn't really feel that way. And that's cool that you can do that. But, you know, I personally have a lot of respect for people who can just whatever the hell is in their brain, just let it out. And I think he does it well. And he also does it really poorly sometimes. Heather Crissell is somebody right now that I go back to her a lot. She's really modern. I think she put out a book like last year. She's got maybe 4 or 5 books. I don't know. But I'm reading The Trees right now. And the way she writes is some of the most clever shit I've ever heard. Like, absolutely amazing. And really quick and easy to digest. Who else? Maybe Ed Smith, just because I'm reading.
Oh, yeah. You mentioned him.
He's bad. He's not good. Like, I mean, he's genuine. You know, I'll.
It's so bad, it's brilliant.
Yeah, it's awful. Let me go get his book real quick. And I'll read you some of his really bad poetry. But I don't know. It's like he's got this aura about him that that seems to matter to the people. He's got this aura that seems to matter to the people around him. And he also is the type that just doesn't care. Mm-hmm. This is called Sometimes Fucking Seems So Alien.
Okay.
Sometimes fucking seems so alien, like a daydream, once upon a time, like waving hello on the freeway, like watching TV, like serving your country, like being alive, like waiting for a bus. That's the whole poem. And I would actually say that's the best thing he's ever written. I haven't read that one yet. I closed my eyes and I experienced a rush. Not a big one, but a nice one just the same. Like, it doesn't... So, you know, I don't know what it is about him, but it's carefree.
He was an insta poet in the 80s.
Yeah. Yeah, he was. It very much is like that. So I would say maybe him.
Okay, wonderful. And who are your 3 favorite classical poets?
Oh God, I don't know. Is
we can skip it if you don't want to. No,
I will. I would say Elizabeth Bishop is up there. She did well for the feminist movement, I think. Mm-hmm. She has a great story. I would encourage reading Elizabeth Bishop if you haven't. She wrote really simply but complex for her time. You know, I think she was 20s, 30s. Wallace Stevens is always golden. Who else? I mean, I guess Emily Dickinson, that just feels like an obvious one, but she was great, you know, she wrote a quarter of a millennial ago the way a lot of people write now. And I think that that's pretty impressive.
Yeah, there's nothing wrong with those classics. Again, I'm a big sucker for Edgar Allan Poe.
Yeah, he's good too.
Yeah. Alrighty then, so that is all of the questions. Thank you so much, J.H. And now we can move on to the poetry recitations. So would you like to recite one of the poems you have?
I will. Let's see here. What should we go first from the book. Yeah, let's do that. I'm just going to...
Again, whichever three that you want.
I'm just going to scroll with my eyes closed, and I'm going to land on something inside of my book, and stop. Okay. So this is called Magenta Cake and the Machine Gun. This world is not for us, don't you see? Follow along with the razors as they flay the night, as they cut into the wrist of dusk's horizon, as the ribbons of moonlight confetti down, shredding down, letting you down. Don't you see? This world is not for us. How could it be when the beautiful die young while the slime sleep through the death of the day and only awake to force the night to its knees without consequence? The world is not for us, don't you see? We can only spend what is left of our stuttering days as we know how, taking in magenta cake and the machine gun sorrow and tilting softly into our wars and flushing the screenplays with the shit and bolting up yesterday's news and feeding the premature epitaphs to the dogs. And forging our love into lethal weapons because it will be necessary if we want to survive in this world that has never been for us.
Ooh, I really like that one. I especially love the combination of the imagery of cutting wrist, but cutting wrist in like, I love the combination of celestial imagery with the moonlight ribbons and the dusk and all that good stuff.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much. Yeah, that was that's a very dark one. Like I said, you know, War Over Easy was written in a darker place, but that's good sometimes, you know, that's
of course
what life is. Let's see.
Okay, yeah, how about another one?
Let's see here. Let's go from the new book. This is a funny one. You know, I don't think I've read this to anybody yet. I wrote this as a joke when I was drunk, and I just liked it, and I thought I would hate it, and I still like it. It's called Toast. I sometimes imagine the solitude of floating into a blank ocean, becoming a piece of toast in the unforgiving sun. The Jaws family circling beneath, Papa Jaws would say, "Honey, breakfast is ready," but Mama Jaws will scold him because he forgot to pick up butter at the Shark Mart, and Baby Jaws won't eat unbuttered toast, and I survive. It is just, I don't know.
Are you drunk or high?
I don't know why I wrote it. I was just like, how can I survive? Maybe I was thinking about surviving shark infested waters. I don't know. So
do you surf? Was that something you literally had to think about at any point?
No, it just came out. I don't know. I was like, the sun turns me into a piece of toast. They don't have butter, so they don't eat me. I don't know.
I can still glean a deeper meaning of, you know, that even if in your own vulnerable position, there may be that one missing variable that saves your butt.
Yeah, I guess that is what it is. But I don't know. It's just nice. It's got some nice imagery to it. It's cute. It's simple. Mm-hmm. What else can I read? I'm going to read
from... Okay, yeah. One more, please.
Let's go from the new book. Well, I'm going to read this one because I haven't read it yet, and I'm kind of curious to know what's in it. So this is called In Our Skies, and I wrote this about this girl that I was briefly seeing. She was a flight attendant. Okay, In Our Skies. The sky is everywhere today. Mine is blue and feels like a strong face. It's so blue and it hurts my eyes. It's like the neon signs of the darkest bars. Yours is gray and needs a cane. You're driving and you're on the run from yours. The hurricane's coming. The hurricane possesses the weaker sky like a demon. And as you hit Asheville, I imagine your sky is shifting blue. Your sky is waiting with wide open arms. Mine is blue and fine as usual. Nothing new here. Nothing at all new. I miss you and I don't know you. I love you and etc. We talk of the new irrelevance of talking. Messages meaning nothing anymore. Not like when birds flew them up into the skies, into the hurricanes, into the blinding blues through the night, into a person's hands. But my sky is blue and fine as usual. Nothing at all new. Nothing's ever new. And I want to strap this poem to the claws of a bird to send it for you. I want to talk to you about your new sky. But I haven't seen a bird in mine for a while now. They've probably all chosen yours.
Interesting. I like it. Actually, it makes me think of one poem from your War Over Easy collection, just because you seem to have an affinity with blue. And there was one particular poem, I can't remember it verbatim, but just discussing like all the blue has been sucked out of the sky or ocean because it's all the blue is in her eyes.
Oh, yeah. I remember that. I think I remember writing that. That was the, I remember writing that it was raining outside and that was the most depressed I had ever felt in my life. And I wrote that poem.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's interesting that you revisit the color of blue again. But yeah. But again, I like the idea of, you know, the two different skies for two different people. Cause you, you know, we think of so many things as objective reality, but the real reality is perception is reality, and that clouds, and this clouds everything we see in life.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. She, you know, she was on the move all the time. You know, she, you know, flies around the country. And I think the superficiality of, you know, texts and everything were getting to me. I think I just started thinking about, you know, the most primitive ways of communication, sending letters, you know, by Blackbird or whatever it is, you know,
by carrier pigeon,
And I was just
or
like,
or crows and ravens, if you're yeah. from Game of Thrones.
Crows and ravens. Yeah. I just, you know, there's nothing.
Or owls and Harry Potter.
Yeah. Everybody's got one. I don't know what Earth is. but yeah, you know, the lack of romance. And so, you know,
yeah,
a lot of what I write about and a lot of what I think, is I'm super anti social media and media in general. I think that,
I could kind of get that vibe.
All of it just destroys it. I think it numbs us. I think that social media is not a, it's not a positive. It feels like a positive. It's like,
there's the superficial notion of connection, but how deep is that connection truly?
Exactly. It's not, you know, it's, I don't know what another, I can't think of an analogy right now, but yes. Okay. It's great that I can contact my grandmother living in Russia. Right. Like, mm-hmm. but when you utilize that ease so often, you lose what makes true relationships important, which is the maintenance of a relationship is hard. If you actually think about it, it takes time. It takes effort, you know, but if we trivialize communication down to some text, like the making everything easy, you're not putting in work anymore. And so, yeah, you will definitely find me writing about that, you know, even in that, like we talk of the new irrelevance of talking.
Interesting. That's got me thinking, that's got me psychoanalyzing myself. And why do I love like BookTube and analyzing the deeper meanings in books so much? Because I'm trying to get to that deeper substance that so often I cannot get to in, again, our modern notions of social media and communication.
At least you're searching.
All righty then. Well, thank you so much for those three special chosen poems. I'm going to read, I think, just two from your collections, a few that I like. So this one is shorter than some of your others in this collection, but I really liked it. Let's see. It's on page 17. Daisies and Fire. We know nothing of who we really are until we skip through daisies and fire and decide in which to lie down.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm a pagan, so I'm a real sucker for the use of the elements as symbolism. So again, earth and fire, right up my alley.
I love it.
So let's see, which other one do I want to do? Let's see, what's page 88? Oh, yes, I love this one. It's called Maybe. So maybe the galaxy is just litter. Maybe the moon and the planets are just marbles and cereal puffs that God had forgotten to clean up after a party one evening. Maybe we are just the mold growing on a dust particle, and soon a broom will come sweep us back into nothing.
Maybe.
I like your use of, again, the celestial, the natural, like very traditional imagery with like really modern metaphors.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's one element of your style that I really, really enjoy, which is why I like the rawness of it, because it combines, I feel like, the modern and the traditional in a way.
Thank you. Yeah, I agree.
Okay. Alrighty then. So that is it for the poetry recitations. No, Gyro. Sorry, my cat just jumped up. Down. Alrighty then. Let's hope he'll just sit there quietly. So then we're going to close on this episode with the exercise I like to call hashtag InstaPoetry. So JH, do you have your cell phone ready?
I got it.
Okay. So I would like you to please, you know, open up Instagram.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm doing so as well. And what I would like you to do is search the hashtag InstaPoetry.
Mm-hmm.
And then don't just go to the top ones, go to the recent ones.
Oh, that's going to make it tough. Okay, I'm here.
Tough in what way?
Because the top usually means it's the ones that had been caught and had gone maybe a little viral. Maybe they have some sort of, you know, standard that's a little, but recent, you know, it could be anything.
And that's kind of why I did it. Like, it could be anything. And for me, like, yes, there's not always the best, but that's why we're here. We talk about them, but I have found some really good ones. So I'm definitely one of those believers in something going viral doesn't necessarily, that in itself is not a quote unquote gatekeeper of quality.
Yes.
Yeah. So that's personally why my method, why I choose to do it this way.
So,
if you can just, you know, pick one that catches your eyes and then you can recite it and then you can talk about it if you liked it, loved it, hated it.
Let's see here. I don't know what to pick.
Just make sure to pick one in English.
I will, but I'm noticing a lot of typos, which is what I knew was going to happen. And I love it. I think that's so good. Okay, I don't even know. This one's just a little bit longer, which is why I'm going to read it, but I haven't read
it. Okay, go for it.
I haven't read it yet, so I don't know if it's good, but we'll. Oh, how I miss you, my gently fleeing heart. Your warm arms, strong beat, solid presence. I wish to dance in the living room with you. I wish to sing in the kitchen. I know you had to go, but this distance feels like poison. Hurry back before something beautiful decays. You know, it's not bad. I think it definitely gets stronger in the latter half.
Mm-hmm. Because I feel like you're kind of the opposite approach, where if you have that sort of, you know, super poetic language, you tend to do those like metaphors and similes like very upfront in the beginning.
Yeah. My thing is, most of the stories don't quite. So if you know, even the poem that I read about In Our Skies, I look at poems like puzzles. And I make sure that the puzzle's complete before it's done. I think everything needs to tie back. That is one thing I'll say about poetry. If you're writing something a little bit longer, it's got to have a strong tie to the beginning, because a lot of untrained writers or people who are just new at it will go off on a tangent, and by the end of the writing, they're nowhere near where they were at the beginning. And that's super common. I think that this one is not quite long enough to where they would have gone off on a tangent. But I can tell that they got more inspired as the poem went on. Oh, how I miss you, my gently fleeing heart. Not good. Your warm arms, strong beat, solid presence. It's not good. I wish to dance in the living room with you. Okay, you've given me some visuals. I'm starting to see something. I'm starting to see a picture, but you're still not saying anything interesting. I wish to sing in the kitchen. Again, you're giving me visuals. You're not seeing anything, or you're not saying anything interesting. But I know you had to go, but this distance feels like poison. Hurry back before something beautiful decays. That's a strong thought.
Yes, it is.
Because I've never seen distance coupled with poison. And
yeah, you exactly.
Close me out with saying something beautiful can decay. And hurry back is really common language, right? Hurry back mm-hmm. before something beautiful decays. So that's beautiful.
Okay. Alrighty then. Wonderful. I'm going to choose one now. This is a person that I didn't realize, but this is Hector, a person that I followed, that I found his poem on a different hashtag #InstaPoetry episode on another one, and I followed him. So yeah, he's good. So this one is for John. Snow to cover my bones, this chapel of ash, I draw my heart like a sword, a blade of bitter cold, my heart a smile to bite, the hand of clutching dark. The work continues, work in the caves that slumber beneath the tired city. The villagers trouble me no further. I am like a stranger here, an ordinary ghost. The world has spun from its flywheel like an eye that weeps rust. Thoughts simmer behind my brow, thoughts that excavate the past. Everything is ancient. Watch where you step.
Yes, that's really nice.
Yeah, he is. Hopefully I can reach out to him and hopefully get him on this podcast as well.
Yeah, I like that poem a lot. I think it's super simple, and he's got really strong pieces. Chapel of Ash, you know.
Mm-hmm, yes, exactly.
Nice, and then I think he ends it well with "Watch Where You Step."
Right. Okay. Would you like to share one more of your choices?
Sure. No quiero que estamos I'm just kidding. Let's see. I'm just seeing. You know what? Let's share this because this here, I don't mean to be negative. I don't want to be a negative person. But I think that this ties back to the question you had about the rift between, you know, the old guard literary poets and Insta poets. This right here is what makes them mad. So this poem,
go for it.
Be someone's moon in between the stars. It doesn't mean anything. You can't quite hold on to the visual. And the only visual pieces are moon and stars. How many poems have we seen that talk about the moon and the stars? If you're going to write about the moon and the stars, you have to do it in a completely original way. You have to stretch your mind to do so. And of course, this hasn't blown up. It's, you know, it's only got one like. But we've both seen, you know, we've seen enough Insta poetry to where we've seen things like this with thousands of likes. And I think that that's, where the trouble lies in that riff. But
yeah, and I can understand the poetry establishment to a certain extent as well, because I personally have my own, like, quote unquote, code of conduct when it comes to poetry. Like, to me, even if a poem is like an Insta poem, if you will, like, I still give that poem, my poems are typically, the ones I put on Instagram are normally 8 to 12 lines. Like, it still has a little bit of something. Like, if it's shorter than that, then I'm, you know, that's usually something, if anything, that's something I've worked really, really hard to try and pack a really deep meaning into something really short. Like I personally, even if I thought of those lines for a longer poem, like, I would not settle for just for putting those lines on Instagram.
For sure. Yeah, that makes total sense.
Alrighty then. And that concludes episode 6 of Insta Poetic Justice. Thank you so much for joining us, JH. It was a real pleasure interviewing you and hearing all of your insights.
Amy, thank you so much. This was beautiful. I had a great time.
Yes, wonderful. Again, everyone who's listening, don't forget to check out War Over Easy, which is available at Amazon.com. Again, it's really great, raw, but poetic with nature and the modern, and it is awesome. So yeah, tune in next time, and we will discuss Insta poetry with another guest poet. Have a good day, everyone. Bye.
Bye.